The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Apple China iPhone sales dive 19% in the worst quarter since 2020. And this is a big issue because we know that China represents approximately 20% of the sales for Apple. It's obviously critical to their supply chain. So if there's one company that, at least to my mind, that has quote-unquote China risk associated with it, it's Apple. Mandeep Singh joins us here. He's a senior technology analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us here in our New York City studio. So Mandeep, Apple China iPhone sales dive 19% in the first quarter, the worst since 2020. What's your takeaway there?
I mean, it's not new news. Okay. So we knew this was coming. There was some counterpoint data, I think, last month that their March sales were pretty bad. So expected, but it kind of solidifies the point that, the China weakness is playing out much worse than what people expected. And the China revenue probably is going to be like this for the foreseeable future, unless something changes at the geopolitical level or Apple launches a new device that everyone wants, that latest iPhone that everyone would want. But for now, Huawei and the domestic competitors seem to be catching up in terms of features, and that's enough to take the share in the domestic market.
So this is a story then of consumers shifting to competitors, or is it just that demand for phones is down because there's some macro weakness in the Chinese consumer?
I think there is a policy element to it as well. So obviously a lot is kind of driven by what is done at the government level. First, they banned, the use of iPhones, and now they're making sure that the domestic vendors have a good chance of taking share. Mm-hmm. And because the phone is comparable in features, then I guess the Apple lock-in that everyone thought was so strong that you just can't get out of your iOS isn't really helping in this case. And they are able to kind of move out of the iOS ecosystem and start using this new phone.
What's Apple say about their position in China, what they may need to do to regain momentum? Do they have any strategy they've articulated?
I mean, look, they are having an event on May 7th where they are launching a new iPad lineup. There will be something very similar for the iPhone. They will launch a new device with AI capabilities. So their play is, we will launch a new phone, a new tablet with AI capabilities that everyone is looking for. And hopefully that drives the refresh cycle.
And how does the slumping demand in China compare to the U.S. demand? Because I have to admit, a lot of people feel very peer pressure to stay with an iPhone versus a different device, simply because if you're in a group chat and you have blue text messages, like, it seems like that's actually a really strong feature that can ramp up demand, at least in the U.S. So how does that compare, and how are you looking at that?
So I will say, I think Apple is still gaining share in other markets, U.S., India, other pockets as well outside of China. But that China revenue is almost 20% of their sales. Mm-hmm. And if it's going to be zero a couple of years from now, then you have to ask yourself, what makes for that revenue shortfall? Mm-hmm. And for a variety of reasons, as we talked about, related to China. But even if they are doing well in other regions, it's just pressure in terms of unit sales. And what do you do? Do you keep raising the prices of the phone, which they may have to because they have to relocate the supply chains out of China? That's the other aspect of it, the cost pressures when it comes to making this phone. They will have a lot of that because they have to relocate those supply chains, and it's not easy.
I'm surprised they haven't taken a more aggressive approach in India? Like maybe a lower cost model to appeal to that marketplace. What's their India strategy?
I mean, so far, I think they are catering to that premium segment, and they have had success, you know, in terms of that 1% or 2% penetration that they have had, you know, in terms of the region. But a low-cost phone, it's hard in India simply because how low can you go? And Apple has tried that with different SKUs in the past. They haven't had a ton of success with low-cost phones because, again, the competitors are quite fierce when it comes to, you know, the feature set and the quality of the phones that they offer. And so it will be an interesting strategy if they decide to pursue that. But for now, I don't think anything can make up for that China revenue shortfall because it's declining at a very rapid pace.
So their earnings aren't until May 2nd. They have that launch event on May 7th. But we do have some other big tech earnings coming this week. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, look, Meta, I think it's a company that has had a great turnaround story. And we know turnarounds are tough in tech, but Meta has shown that, you know, it's a remarkable story when it comes to laying off 25% people and then growing revenue 25% in subsequent quarters. I mean, it just speaks for how well they have executed. And now they are at the top of the game when it comes to having their own large language model. So that could make a difference in terms of, you know, the new revenue stream that everyone wants to see with Meta, and probably the metaverse may become a sideshow. I think another company that I feel is not very well understood and probably everyone thinks they're going to get disrupted is Google Alphabet. Mm-hmm. And that's where it would be interesting to see what they do around search, because all the survey work that we have done, it shows that you know, the new companies, ChatGPT, Perplexity, they have taken some share when it comes to the search queries. Now, still, the counter argument is everyone still needs to go to Google Maps or Google Search to look at what ChatGPT is generating because they're not sourcing the links. So in the end, Google is still getting the traffic, but obviously the search is starting somewhere else, and that's the key risk that they have to address.
All right. So does Google have an AI play per se?
Yeah. So their Gemini large language model, I mean, we all know it wasn't a success initially, but now they have caught up in terms of features. And look, Google doesn't want to integrate Gemini everywhere because that's going to hurt their ad revenue. So they're very careful with how they roll out and how they make those UI changes because it's going to be disruptive to their incumbent position when it comes to digital ads market.
Do you use Gemini?
I do, and I think for certain tasks like generating summaries and you know, video editing, that kind of stuff, image editing, it's great, but I don't use it for my search yet because when it comes to the traditional Google search, it's still the go-to place when I think about, you know, certain things to do, and that's the behavior I have.
All right, you're our guy, Mandeep Singh, senior tech analyst. When you start using something, I'll start using it. And when Anurag tells me to upgrade my phone, I'll upgrade my phone. That's how I roll. Mandeep Singh, senior tech analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. iPhone, China, Apple. It's a big challenge for them, as Mandeep said. Almost 20% of the revenue comes out of China. Mm-hmm. They need to figure that out.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Family Grafeo, Paul Sweeney, we're live here in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. We're streaming live on YouTube as well. Emily Grafeo, a proud graduate of the University of Richmond. I'm sorry, University of Virginia, sorry. Slip of the tongue. As is our next guest, Garrett Nelson, Vice President and Senior Equity Analyst at CFRA Research. Garrett, my notes here say you're in Richmond, Virginia. How did you work that scam?
That's right. Only an hour from Charlottesville. As a proud Who, very happy living so close to the alma mater.
All right, very good. I'm surrounded by UVA folks. Hey, Garrett, Elon Musk, let's talk Tesla. You're the auto dude at CFRA. What does he have to do on the conference call today? It seems like he's got to pull a rabbit out of some kind of hat here to reverse the bad mojo around the stock.
Yeah, look, there's no question the stakes are extremely high heading into this earnings release. The stock is down more than 40% year to date, coming off a year in which shares more than doubled. Tesla's earnings execution also hasn't been great. They've missed on the bottom line each of the last 2 quarters. But we think the challenges they face at this point are well understood by investors. They're having issues with the ramp up of production of the Cybertruck. The EV market overall is oversaturated, and growth rates have slowed tremendously. And there's some uncertainty regarding the future product pipeline, when they might bring to market the mass market EV or robotaxi. That's not really clear right now. So certainly a lot to look for. There's always a lot on the line. Tesla is one of the most anticipated earnings releases every quarter, but even more so this quarter.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about Tesla's efforts to cut prices on their vehicles and how that is going to play into the earnings? I see a lot of headlines about cutting costs. They recently slashed prices, I think 2 weeks ago, on most of their models. Is that something that investors should be watching for even more today in the earnings?
Yeah, so Tesla's been cutting prices steadily for over a year now. Remember, just after the new year in 2023, they announced a price cut, a series of price cuts, and there have been several price cut announcements since then. So it's going to impact both the top line and the bottom line. You're really going to see it in the gross margins that they report. So, also Tesla's at a point where they opened 2 new factories just a couple years ago in Austin and in Berlin, and they're still in the process of ramping those plants up to full capacity. So, if they can do that, cut prices and drive sales higher, they can drive down their unit costs by doing so. Auto manufacturing is a very high fixed cost business. So ultimately, they want to run those plants at the highest possible capacity utilization rate, without surrendering too much margin.
So, Garrett, I guess to me, thank you, blue button. To me, Garrett, I think probably the most fundamental issue here, and I'm not sure Elon Musk can really address it, is what is the overall fundamental long-term demand for EVs? There's a lot of folks out there that are saying it's not great. It's not what maybe the industry once thought. What's your view on that?
yeah, I think that's a big reason behind the sell-off in Tesla and other EV manufacturers. I mean, look at the stock price of Rivian, Lucid, Fisker. Is that the growth rates have disappointed, compared to what investors thought growth would look like just 2 or 3 years ago. So, it's been a disappointment. And one thing you can point to is that governments around the world are putting EV mandates in place. And so, that we think that's a big positive for Tesla. Obviously, as an EV pure play, you're also seeing a number of traditional auto manufacturers really pull back on their planned EV investments. So over the longer term, there should be a lot less competition in the EV market for Tesla, which really opens up the market opportunity.
What else makes Tesla different than other pure play EV manufacturers? If you read the Walter Isaacson biography of Elon Musk's, you kind of get a sense that Musk never wanted Tesla to just be an EV company, but thinks of it more as an AI company, a battery company. How much does that matter to investors right now when the stock is down, 40% year to date?
We argue it should matter. I mean, they have an energy business, energy storage, that if you look last year, it's been growing faster than the auto business. They hardly get any credit for that business. And so, we think it should matter. But really, the big distinguishing factor when you look at Tesla relative to other competitors is its balance sheet. This isn't the Tesla of 3 or 4 years ago that was just barely getting by. Tesla today has an investment grade balance sheet. They're sitting on over $29 billion of cash. They have some of the highest gross margins in the industry. And we think they have an attractive development pipeline. So, that's really, you've seen a bifurcation in the market where, some of the smaller, newer EV players like the ones I mentioned, you know, some of them have either declared bankruptcy or are flirting with bankruptcy. So, you know, Tesla is really in a much different position than those companies. And in fact, a lot of traditional auto manufacturers don't even have investment grade balance sheets. So, you know, they're in a better position than those companies, in our opinion.
Garrett, do you have the confidence that Tesla can profitably make an EV at a $35,000 price point?
Going to be difficult. So, you know, when Elon Musk first started talking about this mass market EV years ago, it, you know, it was a $25,000 EV. And that just isn't, you know, with inflation that we've experienced since then and the economy continues to experience, we think, you know, if this happens, it's more likely to have a price point somewhere north of 30,000, maybe 30 or 35,000. And that's really a price point that they're going to need to produce it profitably in this environment.
I have two questions. One quick question.
Yo.
We talked about the balance sheet. Does Tesla still have Bitcoin on their balance sheet? Remember when news came out like 2 years ago?
Yep. They do. And
interesting.
You know, that was a drag on Tesla for a while when Bitcoin was falling, with Bitcoin having rebounded. You know, they've divested some of the Bitcoin, but they do have some amount on the balance sheet. I would have to check the 10K for the exact amount, but they do still have some Bitcoin.
The other question I had was just when the earnings come out, you know, what are you looking for? Best case scenario, you know, what kind of headline would you have to see to, you know, start buying more Tesla after the earnings?
Really, the biggest thing is we're looking for some certainty regarding the Cybertruck. From as far as we can tell, from the time they made first deliveries of that vehicle in November, you know, through the end of March, they've only produced maybe a few thousand units of the Cybertruck. Now, the reservation count for that model is somewhere north of 2 million. So you have 2 million customers out there who are awaiting delivery of their Cybertruck. They're having difficulty ramping up production. There was a recall just announced. And so, you know, we're looking for some certainty regarding when they might hit certain production milestones for the Cybertruck, which is going to have an impact on their full year deliveries, obviously, and then looking ahead into 2025. But, you know, if you look across the street, earnings estimates have come down massively for 2024. And so we think they're at a level which are much more achievable here. And so the story becomes more of a 2025 and beyond story, which is what investors are looking for, you know, taking a longer term view, but also they want to see better execution in the near term.
All right, Garrett, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Garrett Nelson, Vice President, Senior Equity Analyst, CFRA Research, a proud Wahoo from the University of Virginia, somehow working his scam from Richmond, Virginia, one of my favorite towns anywhere. My twins were born there. Great city, great place to live. So Garrett's got it figured out there, doing the Wall Street thing from Richmond, Virginia. Good for him. Tesla, after the close, that's going to be big.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
One of the big names reporting today is UPS, Big Brown. Profit higher than analyst estimates. Talk about headcount management, restructuring of its delivery routes are beginning to bear some fruit. Let's check in with the expert on all things transport, and that would be one Lee Klaskow. He's their senior transportation logistics analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. He's safely ensconced down in our Princeton office, and he joins us there via Zoom. So, Lee, it looks like this UPS put us in good numbers. What are really the drivers here?
Yeah, hey Paul, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I think it's really about what they're doing on the cost side. I think that's really the driver of the outperformance in EPS, because revenue did come in slightly lower than expectations on lower volumes. They're dealing with lower volumes from lost share last year when they were negotiating their labor contract, and a lot of shippers kind of try to find other alternatives in case there was an issue with their network from a strike, but obviously that didn't happen. Now they're being pretty busy trying to win back that share. So net, I think what they're all in all, it was a good quarter. I think if UPS is meeting or beating expectations, that's a good thing, because they've had a rough year, driven a lot by that labor negotiation, which increased costs considerably and resulted in a lost amount of volume, which for a company like UPS, the deleveraging effect on margins is quite substantial. But there was definitely some good news in the report today, that we remain optimistic that they might be even looking to possibly increase, their full year guidance for 2024, especially as the U.S. Postal Service contract, which they recently won from FedEx, starts hitting their P&L.
When you talk about average daily package volume down year over year, revenue down year over year, how much
Sure.
of the softer demand for UPS is related to macroeconomic factors and maybe coming out of the pandemic, consumers shipping less? Is that a factor here?
Yeah, I think it's probably a trifecta of things. It's probably a softer freight outlook altogether. That coupled with tougher comparisons and the fact that they are still trying to win back the share that they lost from their labor contract negotiations. So I think those three things are kind of weighing on their volumes probably more than maybe their competitors like a FedEx or a DHL.
Hey Lee, I know labor is a big deal with UPS and these companies here. I know UPS, they had a new labor contract that really pushed up wages and benefits starting, I guess, this year. But then on the other side, they also cut 1,200 or 12,000 white collar jobs. That's like 14% of the workforce here. So talk to us about the labor and the component there in the cost structure.
Yeah, I mean, net, they're doing the right things. The contract might have a, with the Teamsters might have had a negative impact to margins, but we are going to anniversary those in the second half of the year,
Okay.
so those comparisons won't be as bad. And also, it does provide them with a steady labor force. Because, if your labor is happy, you're going to have less turnover. You have less turnover, you probably have better service and better safety, and that usually yields better profits. So I think, like, if you look longer term, beyond the initial shock of that new contract, which is very front loaded, the increases aren't as bad as we get to year two. It's not going to be as bad. And listen, UPS and FedEx and a lot of these companies, they did get a little on the fat side, if you will, on their corporate ranks. And I think they're both doing the right things in terms of trimming it for the new normal of what their operating environment is today.
How should investors be thinking about UPS? The stock is up 1.5% right now, but it's down about 6% year to date, underperforming the broader market.
Yeah, and if you even look even further over the last 12 months, it's down almost 25%, underperforming not only the broader market, but its closest peer, FedEx, which is up around 18% over the last 12 months. So, I think what they need to do is they need to execute. They not only need to execute on their 2024 plans, but their 2026 plans. And I do, as I said earlier, I think there is some opportunity for some upside surprise given their U.S. Postal Service contract. It wasn't didn't really make that much money for FedEx, but I think UPS's network is very different than FedEx's. It's more integrated. It's not a hub and spoke network, and that will provide them with some profitability. And management is pretty confident, or at least appears confident, that this business is going to be not only accretive to earnings, but accretive to margins. And that's kind of what, we, as we look at the company, really want to see. We really want to see those domestic margins start to improve.
Hey Lee, what are the companies saying about kind of normalized growth rates in terms of I guess, unit volume. Where's this U.S. economy in terms of just packages? Is it a GDP kind of number? Is that kind of the story?
Yeah, it's a GDP kind of number, but, you know, UPS wants to grow beyond GDP, and how they're going to do that is they've made some pretty significant, not in size necessarily, but in terms of, you know, capabilities, acquisitions. You know, they bought a company, Roadie, which, you know, it's not a drink on the road, Paul, but it is. What they do is they deliver heavy stuff to people's doors. So think furniture, think workout equipment, fitness equipment, and that is done through more or less an asset-light model, where, you know, they're arranging the delivery. So that's a very good business. They're also invested or acquired a company that does returns without having to box it. So it's a lot easier for consumers to, you know, either go to a UPS store or one of the other drop points that UPS provides to return something. And that's good for UPS because that stuff goes into their system and it becomes a B2B delivery, where when we say B2B, business, and meaning that there's more density. So it, you know, they're shipping, you know, they're consolidating and shipping 20 boxes versus just one envelope, and that tends to be more profitable. And then their investments in the healthcare space. You know, their goal is to be the largest healthcare logistics provider. Healthcare has above average margins for transportation companies, given the high level of service that's involved there. Think temperature control. Think, you know, the fact that it has to get somewhere at a very specific time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are higher margin business. So, you know, I think that those growth areas that I just mentioned will help them grow their overall volumes beyond, you know, just GDP numbers.
All right, just real quickly, Lee, I'm looking at the stock. Oh my God, over the last 5 years, UPS and FedEx both grew at a compounded annual rate of 8.8%, spot on, below the S&P 500 of 13%. But why do investors own these stocks? What's the call to own a FedEx or a UPS?
Well, Paul, as you know, we don't do recommendations here at BI, but, you know, it's a play on e-commerce. It's a play on the global economy. And, you know, it's more and more becoming a play on nearshoring. You know, the UPSs and the FedExes and the DHLs of the world, even the freight forwarders like Akuna and Ogle, you know, they're all going to benefit from the changes in supply chains. As supply chains, you know, change and shift and get more complicated, these companies really prove their worth during these times. And, you know, I think that if you believe in nearshoring, if you believe in, you know, the fact that we're going to be buying more online, not less, these are places where you want to be. And it's really about the management teams that are in place, whether it's UPS or FedEx. Can they change their organizations to the new normal? And it looks like they're both doing it. It's not going to be an overnight change. It's going to take time because these are very, you know, huge networks, and they're not as easy to change as it would, you know, changing a menu at a restaurant.
Right, right. All right. Hey, Lee, thanks as always for joining us. Lee Klaskow, Senior Transportation Analyst of Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from the Princeton offices of Bloomberg here.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Some PMI data came out here from S&P, generally below consensus. I guess the composite came in at 50.9 versus 52. That was a consensus, and 52.1 was for the last period as well. Chris Williamson joins us. He's the chief business economist at S&P Global Market Intelligence. Chris, walk us through kind of what we saw here with the PMIs for the month of April.
Yeah, so there's two surveys, really, one of manufacturing, one of services. So the latter is private sector services. This ranges from consumer-based services to business services. It excludes retail, importantly, and it excludes government. Now, both of those surveys lost some momentum. Collectively, over the first quarter, they'd signaled fairly decent growth around 2% annualized, with that upturn becoming increasingly broad-based, services-led, but manufacturing also starting to pick up some momentum. But in April, we've seen both of those surveys lose some output growth pace. Still in expansion territory as far as output's concerned, but with growth sort of slipping below the 2% annualized GDP rate. That's the signal from it. So looks like the second quarter could disappoint compared to the first quarter based on these survey data, as your previous interviewee was referring to. These survey data have been a bit softer than recent GDP numbers. So, you know, that needs to be borne in mind.
So any sense of what's driving that? Like, I'm not sure how to think about this on a month-to-month basis. Is it just kind of noise month-to-month and I really want to look at it on a longer trend? Or does the slowdown in April, does that kind of suggest something might be afoot?
Yeah, it does look like there's been some adjustment to demand. So new order inflows, the amount of work flowing into manufacturers and service providers, that fell for the first time in 6 months in April. Only just, it was a small decline, but this contrasts with growth of demand that we've seen over prior periods. And it looks like you're getting some adjustment here to the financial conditions that businesses are facing. So previously we've seen, you know, companies look forward to rate cuts and that stimulating demand, those loosening of financial conditions. And over the course of the last few weeks, we've seen further signs that you're not going to get all those rate cuts that you hoped. And indeed, market's starting to price in now more possibility of a rate hike. That's feeding through to markets. It's increasing borrowing costs. And it looks like that's feeding through to the business environment. We've seen we've seen this creep in before in terms of how those financial conditions really do seem to quickly affect the demand environment. And it looks like that's what we've got here in April. A bit of a sort of reality check. Whether this persists in coming months is going to be the key thing to look out for. But it does look like that certainly going into the second quarter, you're seeing the demand environment soften compared to what we've seen previously.
All right, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Chris Williamson, Chief Business Economist at S&P Global Markets, joining us from London via Zoom. And again, the S&P Global Manufacturing PMI for the month of April came in at 49.9. Consensus was 52. On the services side, it came in at 50.9, still expansionary, but below the consensus of 52. And both of those were down from last month, which were both close to 52. So again, a deceleration there. So when you put them all together, the services and the manufacturing on a composite basis came in at 50.9 versus 52. So we'll keep an eye on that, a slowdown in the S&P. It's a survey of manufacturing and service activity out there in the economy. Economists kind of take a look at that to see about the outlook for services and for manufacturing.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Emily Grafeo sitting in for Alex Steele. I'm Paul Sweeney. We're live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. We're also streaming live on YouTube.com. So head over there and search Bloomberg Podcast. I'm in the process, thanks to Emily's tip, I'm in the process of logging into and loading ClearSpace onto my phone, the app, and that is to self-limit my use of certain social media things that I feel like are wasting my time.
Yes, it blocks your access to the apps, and it actually makes you do a breathing exercise.
Oh, of course.
And it gives you a inspirational quote before you log on. So you really have to question, do I really want to open media right
That's
now?
That's good.
The lock on the liquor cabinet.
Yes.
Yes.
That's the analogy that from our generation. That brings us to TikTok. Because that's a lot of what people are concerned about. And TikTok, it looks like they might be banned here or forced of a divestiture. I don't know what's going on since I'm not a TikToker, but I know it's huge because most people are on TikTok. Matt Schoettenhelm, I don't know if he's on TikTok. I'm going to guess no, but I don't know. He's a media litigation analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Yeah, he's a lawyer, but we talked to him anyway because he's really, really smart. Matt, can you tell us what's going on with our good friends at TikTok? What is Congress looking to do?
Yeah, so this bill is really advancing in Congress faster than I think many of us expected. The aim of this bill is that to force a divestiture of TikTok from ByteDance, which is based in China and is the parent company here. And basically, the bill operates by saying if that divestiture doesn't happen within 270 days, or maybe there's a potential 90-day extension of that, if that divestiture doesn't happen, then TikTok can't be hosted in app stores, or it can't be there can be no web hosting of the app. So it's effectively a ban if that divestiture doesn't happen. And so this has cleared the House of Representatives on Saturday. That was their second vote by an overwhelming bipartisan majority. Today, it's teed up in the Senate. And this is tied to the Ukraine foreign aid package. And so it's going to be very unlikely for the Senate to resist it. So very likely that this becomes law. President Biden has said he'll sign it. And so I think we're off to the courts now on this question.
What is Congress most concerned about when it comes to TikTok? Why have they introduced this legislation?
Yeah, I think it's really motivated by two concerns. One, it's a concern about access to all of this data. We have 150, 170 million Americans on this. TikTok is collecting all of their data about what they're clicking on, and potentially China has access to that since ByteDance is located within China. And the other concern is a propaganda concern. How much can China play a role in dictating the messages that TikTok prioritizes and what the messages that it's declaring to our youth, you know, that are using this so often. So it's sort of those dual concerns that have really driven this.
Hey Matt, what have we heard from ByteDance, if anything? What are they intend to do if Congress passes this?
Yeah, I think they've signaled pretty clearly that there will be a lawsuit to challenge this. And so I think that's going to be the next stage. So we saw this when President Trump, before he was against a ban, he actually tried to ban TikTok in 2020. And there was litigation about this brought both by TikTok and by TikTok's users. And here the bill itself tells us what court that's going to go to. It's the D.C. Circuit here in Washington. And so I think ByteDance and TikTok are very likely to very soon bring this lawsuit challenging Congress's action.
I think everyone who's on TikTok wants to know, is TikTok going to be banned? What is the likelihood right now that in a couple months people in the U.S. won't be able to use the app?
Yep. So right now there's three moving pieces here. Mm-hmm. So one, will Congress pass this? And I think there the answer is very likely yes, and that's likely to happen today or tomorrow. President Biden will sign it. Then there are two other moving parts. One, can TikTok win in the courts and stop this with a First Amendment challenge? I don't give them very good odds to do that. I give them only about a 30% chance to succeed with the court challenge. Then the last moving piece is, can there be a divestiture of the app? And that one's sort of the big wild card, because what we don't know is whether China will permit a divestiture or not. It has signaled that it won't approve something like that. So even if you put that at a toss-up, 50%, and you say it, you know, TikTok has a 30% chance in the courts, you know, there's a fairly good chance that that the app does disappear in the next year.
How do you ban an app? I mean, how do you ban it technically?
Yeah, so technically the approach here is is to prevent it from being carried in app stores. It can't be updated and made accessible to users in the United States, both in the app stores, and then it can't be hosted. So this app has to sit on a server somewhere that, in a way that makes it accessible. And the approach in this legislation is that if any company makes it accessible through web hosting or through app store access, that they are subject to significant penalties and fines in a case brought by the FTC. So that's the enforcement mechanism here. It's not directly against ByteDance or TikTok. It's against those that would make the app available.
Well, can't I just have some server in China or somewhere else, overseas, do it?
That might be the workaround. Maybe they'll try to do something like that, and then you have a question of how well the U.S. could enforce that. I guess that would be maybe the next move if everything else is failing for TikTok.
All right. So, but the bottom line is, for you lawyer types, you think this is going to go to the Supreme Court?
Well, the D.C. Circuit gets it first, and I think there's a decent chance that the D.C. Circuit is the final word. I think if the D.C. Circuit were to rule for TikTok and to say that there is a First Amendment challenge, that's really going to interest the Supreme Court. I think that would motivate the Supreme Court to take a look at it. If the D.C. Circuit issues a definitive ruling upholding Congress's law here,
yep.
Maybe the Supreme Court says, look, the D.C. Circuit got it right. We don't need to take that up.
Okay. All right. Good stuff. That's why we like talking to you. We get it straight, the straight poop on all the legal stuff. He gives you like percentages of what could actually happen.
We love
that. That's why we love talking to Matt Schottenhelm. He's one of those people that doesn't carry cash. That's the big, big mark against Matt Schottenhelm. Otherwise, he's a great attorney and a great litigation analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. But he's like the kids. They don't carry cash,
We don't need
how
cash.
How do you buy a bottle
of
water sitting on the corner?
I had a food truck outside the office. They took Apple Pay.
They took Apple Pay. All right, there you go.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.